It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the president called for an end to conversion therapy for young people last week. We'll find out what this means for the LGBT community.
First, our next guest tells the untold story of the history of cooperation behind one of Wisconsin's best-known environmental landmarks, the Aldo Leopold Memorial Reserve.
Stephen Laubach tells the story of the land before Leopold bought it and the complicated, sometimes contentious group management that's held it in stewardship over the years.
Stephen A. Laubach joins us now. He's the outreach specialist in the UW Arboretum Earth Partnership Program and the author of Living a Land Ethic. Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
Well, today the farmland and the shack that Otto Leopold bought is famous thanks to his articulation of what a land ethic means and, of course, his book, A Sand County Almanac. But what was this land like before Leopold bought it?
So the land that's now the Leopold Memorial Reserve had been inhabited for thousands of years. Ancestors of what are now the Ho-Chunk Nation members settled there soon after glaciation. More recently, I should say there are also artifacts nearby in Natural Bridge State Park, not far away, dating back to about 10,000 years. And there's a active hunter and gathering culture and farming there. More recently, settlers arrived in the area around the 1850s. And by the 1880s, Wisconsin actually in that area was approaching the maximum amount of cultivated land. So there was sheep farming, there was corn, oats, wheat, and hops. There was a hops craze there as well in the 1860s and 1870s before insect pest.
And I understand that the people who lived on this land, who farmed it before Leopold bought it, he would sometimes say they were moonshiners and leave it at that, but you actually found out there's a richer story there.
Yeah, that chapter was actually part of a paper I wrote for Bill Cronin's environmental history class at UW while I was in graduate school. And I looked at the plat records and the farm records in the State Historical Society and found the name of the farmer's name is Jacob Alexander and his wife's name was Emma. And it was actually a tragic Depression era story of someone who was not able to make a go on that land and had to move out to California. Appears that he couldn't get away from Wisconsin. He came back and died of a heart attack soon after. So when Leopold encountered it, there was a Dust Bowl era in Wisconsin as well, kind of a mini Dust Bowl, and it was blown over a corn stubble.
What do you think it is? As someone who spent a lot of time on this land, gotten to know the Leopold family, what is it about this land that makes it so special, both when Aldo Leopold was living and working on it and today?
When Leopold bought it, it actually wasn't for its spectacular views. He bought it because he saw potential for what is now called ecological restoration. He bought a kind of a forlorn piece of land and had a vision for restoring a landscape that had largely been destroyed even by the 1880s in Wisconsin. And so I think that's what makes it special, that story of renewal and restoration that gives hope to continuously gives hope to people in the conservation field like myself that land, even if you encounter it in a somewhat degraded form with some attention and care, can be returned to something special. And of course there are features there that I think are beautiful. There's the Wisconsin River just to the north of his shack. There's rolling glacial moraines on all sides, wetlands all around. So it isn't that it's forlorn and kind of ugly duckling. I think it is beautiful in its own right. It just may not be as spectacular as the Rocky Mountains.
Right now we're talking with Stephen Laubach. He's the author of Living a Land Ethic, taking a look at some of the cooperative conservation that surrounds the Aldo Leopold Memorial Reserve. And to catch us up on that angle, Stephen, in 1967, something kind of interesting happened. Five families joined together to take care of this land, you know, as a group, as a unit. How did that come about?
Yeah, so there were two main families involved in this, the Leopold family, obviously. But in the late 60s, actually, Aldo Leopold had passed away, and all of his children were kind of establishing their careers out of state. And so there was another family, the Coleman family. Aldo Leopold and Tom Coleman were hunting friends and close friends, and Tom Coleman owned Madison Kipp Corporation, or was the CEO of Madison Kipp, and his son Reed is now. And so the Coleman family actually, Reed Coleman by this time was in his 30s, kind of took the lead. He looked ahead, and the Interstate 90-94 had just come through there. Some lots just to the east of the shack along the Wisconsin River. It was getting subdivided into small 30-foot lots. They were getting sold. And he looked ahead, and it wasn't hard to imagine a time when, if someone didn't think about this, that the land all around there would look very different than it did in his childhood and in Leopold's time. So he came up with the idea of a cooperative agreement among the private landowners in the area who cared about Leopold's legacy. So he got the Leopold family to sign on, but there's also the family of Frank Terbilcox, who ended up being a land manager there afterwards, and two other families, the Van Hoosen and Anker families. The Coleman, Reed Coleman and his friends Howard Mead, who later went on to start Wisconsin Trails magazine, and Frank Terbilcox just went knocking on doors up and down, you know, for 3 or 4 miles along the Levee Road, what it's called. And they enlisted the support of these two additional families in addition to the Terbilcox and Leopold and Coleman families.
How unusual was this kind of model for conservation? This seems like an unusual sort of thing going on.
Yeah, it was definitely unusual. I think up to that time in the American conservation history, a more common approach would be to set aside land under, you know, state or federal jurisdiction. It wasn't unheard of, though. Leopold himself had started several cooperative ventures that I kind of allude to the note in the book. The Riley Game Cooperative was one where he set up a cooperative agreement among farmers and cities where the city members could use the farmers' land for hunting, and they would help with the finances and maintenance of some of the hedgerows and other areas to create better hunting habitat on the unused portions of the farm. So that was one example. There was the Fayville Grove Wildlife Area, also started by Leopold. So Leopold had kind of, he in his time in the Forest Service from the early 1900s through the mid-20s, had engaged in several activities with private landowners. So it was definitely not common, but there was some precedent there, and people were familiar with Leopold's legacy, were aware of that, and hoped to carry it on.
And eventually, nonprofits were born out of that original five-family group, the Sand County Foundation, the Aldo Leopold Foundation. What role do they play today?
Yeah, so the Sand County Foundation was the original foundation formed by the Coleman family in 1967 when the Leopold Reserve was formed. A little later, the Aldo Leopold's five children formed the Aldo Leopold Foundation in 1982. And they both have assumed, the Leopold Foundation started by primarily assuming management of the property that the Leopold family had originally owned within the Leopold Reserve, and also heading up, you know, if people wanted to come for tours and things like that after the Leopold Foundation was formed, and then a few years later, they ended up taking more responsibility there. But it's kind of been a dynamic relationship. Both have been involved in land management and ecological restoration there and outreach. And as the years have gone on, they've kind of expanded their vision either to other sites or bringing a national audience, national attention to how the Leopold Reserve is an example of a land ethic in action.
Now, with that many people involved, there must have been times when things didn't go so smoothly because people had competing interests. I know that one of the Leopold children wanted to donate the land to the university, and another wanted to focus on science there on the land and just bring scientists in, things like that. How did that work out when there were competing interests going on?
Yeah, so there are competing interests within the two families and their nonprofits, across the families. I think it would be extremely unusual if that weren't the case. And so in this case, they've been able to maintain that reserve legacy over a 45 to 50-year period, which is quite impressive. But yeah, there have been slightly different visions of conservation. The Sand County Foundation emphasizes more conservation on private lands. The Leopold Foundation, their focus has been on bringing kind of a national conversation about a land ethic and what it means to put a land ethic in action on that land. And so they've had to negotiate some differences in opinion within the family, too. Within the Leopold family, there were at one point they were thinking of donating it to the university, as you mentioned. But then the younger generation said, you know, we want this legacy to stay in the family. So there was example of dialogue across generations and you know, convincing the elders that it was worth it to keep in the family.
Stephen, thank you so much for coming on and sharing that history with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
We've been speaking with Stephen Laubach, the outreach specialist in the UW Arboretum Earth Partnership Program and the author of Living a Land Ethic.
Last week, President Obama called for an end to what's known as conversion therapy when used on minors. Conversion therapy is a practice with the goal of changing the sexual orientation or gender identity of gay, lesbian, and transgender people.
Well, the president isn't looking for a federal law banning that practice. He is hoping states will follow the example of California, New Jersey, and the District of Columbia and ban it at a state level. Michael Scheer joins us now. He's the White House correspondent for the New York Times. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to do it. Nice to talk to you.
Well, how did the president make this announcement calling for an end to conversion therapy?
Well, so this came, the specific genesis of it was a petition, an online petition. The White House website allows people to post petitions on any subject on the White House website. And if they get enough signatures, then the White House commits to at least respond to them. They don't obviously commit to doing whatever the petitioners want, but they at least commit to responding. In this case, folks urged the president to take a stand on this issue of so-called conversion therapy in the wake of a very tragic story of a 17-year-old transgender youth who had become so despondent about her parents' efforts to convert her, essentially try to convert her back to being a boy, that she killed herself. And in the wake of that, friends started a petition to urge the president to weigh in, and last week the White House decided to go ahead and do that.
And this is Leila Alcorn. The president was reportedly pretty moved by that story. For people who aren't necessarily familiar with what conversion therapy involves, could you flesh it out a little for us?
Sure. So essentially, it is a kind of a catch-all term for a set of therapies of sort of therapists who, you know, can be in some cases religious-based, in other cases simply folks who believe that being homosexual is not a permanent thing, and that if you meet with a therapist who kind of helps you through it, that they can essentially convert you back into a heterosexual person, and essentially, depending on the rhetoric that's used, sometimes they say they've quote unquote cured you from being homosexual, and you know, it's something that is largely derided by traditional psychiatric associations and most medical doctors as kind of wrongheaded, but there's a group of folks out there, a group of therapists out there who, you know, believe strongly that it's possible, and they pursue it, and it's most controversial when employed against young people, or employed in the case of young people like Leila Alcorn.
What kind of political pressure was there for the president to speak out on conversion therapy?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it's not one of those issues that, I mean, I cover the White House pretty closely. It's not one of those issues that had been repeatedly brought up, for example, at the daily briefing where the White House gets asked questions on any number of subjects. But it does fit into a kind of broader, what the president himself has called a broader evolution in his presidency on issues regarding, you know, gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender people in this country. Of course, you remember that the president, when he was first entering national politics in running for the Senate in Illinois, he said that he was opposed to gay marriage, supported civil unions, over, you know, then became president essentially on that same platform, and over the time in office in the last 6.5 years became, a greater and greater supporter of gay rights. He ended the don't ask, don't tell policy in the military. He supported gay marriage, finally. And so this is kind of part of that evolution and part of a, you know, pattern where this president has sort of sought to, from his perspective, right the wrongs that have been kind of institutionalized against gay people in this country.
We're talking with White House correspondent Michael Scheer right now. He's with the New York Times, talking about the president's recent call to end what's called conversion therapy, aimed at youth in this case, and a goal of changing the sexual orientation, maybe the gender identity of gay, lesbian, and transgender people. And Michael, the president is not hoping for a federal law to ban this. He's hoping to go at the state level. Why is that?
Well, I think that part of it is largely rooted in political pragmatism and reality. I mean, I talked to Valerie Jarrett, who's a senior advisor to Mr. Obama, and she was pretty clear that if the president thought that federal legislation would actually be considered and approved, I think he'd support it. I think they recognize that the both chambers controlled by Republicans. Those Republicans are not looking out to try to give President Obama a win on anything. And so I think it's more rooted in the idea that, look, you know, that if we set as a goal federal legislation, that's something that's not likely to happen in the next 18 months. But we can. They would say we can, you know, put the weight of the office behind some of these other efforts, and maybe that'll help.
Now, some states, as we said, have banned it. California has, New Jersey has, also the District of Columbia. Has it stood up in court there so far?
So far it has. The court efforts the court challenges have largely failed. There's been one court challenge in New Jersey and one in California, and the laws have been upheld so far. If you talk to the advocates of this practice, they say they are, you know, convinced that what they're doing is legal, and they continue to say that they will fight in court whenever they can. I think there were something like 18 different legislative efforts either that have begun or are still underway in different states to try to do this, and the advocates, the practitioners of conversion therapy are fighting in all of those states to keep those laws off the books, and then they say, if they lose those legislative fights, they, you know, intend to keep fighting in courts.
Now, this is aimed at minors in particular. Is that because there's a potential for an element of coercion with minors who are maybe still living with their parents?
Yeah, you know, I asked the White House about this. I think there was not a really clear answer. I mean, I think if you push the White House, and if you had President Obama here to ask him, he'd probably say that he opposes the practice entirely, whether it's for young people or adults. I think there is that element of, an adult can make a decision to, choose a particular therapy for him or herself. But in the case of young people, there's this element that they're not choosing. And in the case of Lila Alcorn, that was the despair that she wrote about in an internet posting before she killed herself. She wrote about that despair of being forced to undergo these sessions against her will, because that's what her parents had decided that she should do. So I think that element of coercion was probably what helped limit or define the scope of what the president was going to stand against.
What kind of response has this gotten? This White House statement from the president, from LGBT advocates, is this considered a major win or just maybe more of a stepping stone?
Well, it's interesting. I talked to a bunch of the advocates. You know, they all put out statements, the kind of gay rights and LGBT advocacy organizations all put out statements, supporting this and thanking the president and saying that this was a big step forward. I think, though, if you really talk to them, that this is seen as, you know, a kind of niche, important, but a kind of small piece of the broader, you know, broader effort to advance gay rights and to treat gay rights in the similar vein as the kind of civil rights struggle that they've been pursuing for a couple of decades. I think things like gay marriage, which of course is at issue before the Supreme Court at the moment. I mean, those are really seen as the bigger issues that will affect, you know, kind of the broad swath of American life. This particular issue is, you know, as a kind of smaller one. And you could see the difference in the way the president handled this one. The president was actually in Panama at the time that the statement went out. He was on a foreign trip. The statement was posted to the website, and Ms. Jarrett gave a couple of interviews. That's, you know, significantly different than how the president has treated some of these other kind of broader LGBT issues.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, happy to do it.
Michael DeShear is the White House correspondent for The New York Times.
You can share your thoughts on this issue over at the Central Time Facebook page. Americans are spending more than ever on prescription drugs. That's the big finding from a new report out this week, which looked at how much money Americans doled out for their medications in 2014.
All in all, we as a country spent $374 billion on prescription drugs last year. That's a 13% spike from 2013. So why is spending way up, and what are patients getting out of it?
Here with us to try and get to the bottom of the spending is Dr. Jeremy Green. He's a professor of medicine and the history of medicine at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Dr. Green, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me back again. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as somebody who studies medicine and pharmaceuticals, what was your reaction to these spending numbers from last year?
Well, you know, it's hard not to be disappointed on the one hand. We all want to believe that we can get high-quality health care in the United States for a cheaper price tag. And some recent trends have shown prescription spending decreasing in the United States over recent years. A lot of that have been attributed to increased use of generic drugs and price savings that were achieved there. So to witness a further increment of increase in prescription drug spending in the United States is disappointing. Although, in a sense, not surprising. It's been a large and continual cumulative growth in prescription drug spending in the United States over the last half century or more, for the most part.
Well, one thing that kind of surprised me, looking at this new information, new drugs may be a big part of this. How much does a new drug entering the market matter in terms of overall spending?
Well, I mean, I think new drugs are where you traditionally see the highest prices, and especially drugs that have emerged in the last 10 to 20 years have been more expensive, almost by orders of magnitude, than drugs that had emerged in prior decades. Many of this has been attributed to the process of development of biotech drugs, but you know, in the United States drug market, a lot of the problem is that the prices charged are really what the market will bear. We have no effective means of price control in the United States prescription drug market.
Well, and one case made for generic drugs is that they make drugs cheaper overall, but a case made against them in some cases, or against the way the patenting process works, is drug companies, in that window they have before generic alternatives are allowed, they want to make as much money as they can. Is that part of the factor in the high cost of newer drugs?
It's definitely part of the factor, and there's a lot of numbers that gets tossed around here. Most commonly, we see the round figure of $1 billion as the average cost for the R&D from initiation to market for any successful new drug launched in the United States. And, of course, there's a lot of outlay for R&D that's required to develop a new drug. If we want to believe that we should support the development of more innovative pharmaceutical products, then we have to be prepared to see some means for innovative companies to recoup those investments. And so that's really the logic behind much of pharmaceutical regulation, or at least policy surrounding drug access in the United States, where we balance that patent-protected period where an innovative drug company can recoup the costs of innovation using high prices and a patent-protected monopoly, with what we expect to be a reduction of prices once a drug goes off patent and it's available for generic competition. And so we almost make, we naturalize two different stages in the life cycle of a drug. The first, this patent-protected period when the drug is expected to have very high prices, and the second, a generic competition period where we expect drug prices to go down. And really that's how we balance innovation access in the United States, kind of chronologically.
And a story, a big story in medication last year that, I'll be honest, went completely under my radar, the release of new drugs for the disease hepatitis C. Can you talk about that?
Oh, this, yeah, I mean, this is both a triumph and tragedy story. On the one hand, we have seen the development of new drugs that are actually curative and easily administered for the treatment of hepatitis C, which, prior to these new medications, has been a disease with profound chronic complications. The only treatment options for it were very, took quite a long term, were difficult to administer. So this is really, in some ways, a fruit of what we want to see from an innovative pharmaceutical sector. Yet the drugs were priced so high that many state Medicaid programs realized that if they were to allow access to the drugs to all patients that needed them, the state Medicaid programs would simply go bankrupt. And so it became a test case both in demonstrating how the innovative pharmaceutical industry was still capable of producing truly innovative new drugs with dramatic public health potential, and yet the increase in price on these agents over the last few decades has come to the point where this is not simply a question of can something like a new antiretroviral drug for the treatment of HIV/AIDS be accessible in countries in the global north but not in affordable in countries in sub-Saharan Africa. These are questions of new drugs not being available to populations who need them in the United States.
Will they get, even before they hit that generic stage, do they tend to get new drugs, I should say, tend to get cheaper over time?
So pharmacoeconomics is a really difficult field to study. And I want to say at the outset, I'm a clinician, I'm an internist, I'm a historian, but I'm not an economist. And one of the reasons that pharmacoeconomics is so hard to study is it's really difficult for people like me to perceive the true cost of drugs. When pharmacies pay for drugs and insurers pay for drugs, they engage in contracts, bundling contracts, discount contracts with drug companies, often mediated through third parties called pharmacy benefit managers. So it becomes very difficult to understand what the true cost of drugs actually are to any individual entity in the healthcare system. We just see the total price tag at the end in reports like the ones published this week.
Talking to Dr. Jeremy Green, looking at a new report that came out, said we spent a lot of money on pharmaceutical medications last year, 13% increase over 2013, in fact, looking into some of the reasons and consequences for that. Now, one thing, Dr. Green, people are watching is the Affordable Care Act. More people maybe have access to health care, therefore more people have access to medications. Therefore, more money is going into prescription medications. How big a part of the story was that, do you think?
Well, I can't comment right now on the ACA impact in this particular report. Safe to say that, of course, both sides, in such a polarized environment, one can immediately see how both sides will point the finger at either the ACA being a positive dimension in this report or the ACA being a negative dimension in this report. And I think this is one of the casualties we see of healthcare policy in the 21st century in the United States, that evidence immediately gets appropriated to one or another side of a preformed argument.
Now, you recently were quoted by NPR talking about another angle on this story, a drug that's been with us a long time. You'd think it would be generic and cheap by now. Insulin. But you write it's very hard for people always to find inexpensive insulin. Can you tell us that story?
Well, I think the insulin story, in a nutshell, demonstrates several of the problems of increasing price tag of prescription drugs in the United States. Insulin was discovered in 1921. It was first patented in 1923. It's a drug that affects, it's a drug necessary for the treatment of diabetes in about 6 million persons living with insulin-dependent diabetes in this country. And yet there is no generic version of insulin available in the United States as of the year 2015. And to understand why that's true and that a person living without insurance coming to me to my clinic in East Baltimore, for example, would be told at most pharmacies that they'd have to pay $120 to $300 or $400 for a vial, a single monthly vial of insulin, helps us begin to grapple with some of the problems of basic essential medicines remaining out of reach or creating increasing price tags in North America. Now, part of what happened in the insulin story is that insulin has not been one drug continuously from 1921 to the present. If you look in the 30s and 40s, new ways of producing insulin that can last longer in the body were produced. In the 50s and 60s, we see other innovations. But by the late 1970s, the newly developed biotech industry comes up with recombinant human insulin produced by bacteria using recombinant DNA technology. And each of these innovations makes insulin a little bit more effective, a little bit safer, and yet it also helps to keep insulin products that are currently being used on patent and quite expensive. And oddly enough, the older products, which did work, right, animal insulins, pork and beef insulins worked for millions of diabetic patients, are now no longer produced for sale in the United States of America. So the only options available for people living with diabetes are actually quite expensive, even for this old drug.
And what are the consequences? I want to talk about the consequences for the patients you're talking about who can't afford the insulin that's generally available to them in an area.
Well, and I should clarify at the outset that the consequences are quite different for people living with what's called type 1 diabetes, juvenile onset diabetes, in which the pancreas does not produce insulin, and people living with type 2 diabetes or adult onset diabetes, with whom insulin can be necessary to control blood sugar and prevent long-term complications like stroke, gangrene, kidney failure. And one of the things you see is in the week since my colleague Kevin Riggs and I published this article, we received a lot of correspondence from people living with diabetes who have had to pursue different strategies to deal with the high cost of insulin. Many people with type 1 diabetes who don't have insurance find that they need to live their lives around places like Walmart. It turns out Walmart offers $25 a vial insulin that they're able to contract using their huge buying power and a special relationship they formed with the makers of Novalin. They offer a brand called Relyon, which is their house brand of cheap insulin. It's quite interesting that although U.S. pharmaceutical policy does not provide for cheap, affordable insulin for people living with diabetes, the company Walmart has, and so many people living with type 1 diabetes have focused some of their housing moves to be close to Walmart's so that they can know they'll have access to insulin. It's a lifeline. It works for them, but it's a thin one because it's a marketing policy of Walmart, and they could discontinue it at any time. Many people living with type 2 diabetes, many people I see in my clinic, go for a month or two or longer without their insulin and lose control of their diabetes. Their blood sugars go up through the roof, and they have poorly controlled diabetes and face very real bodily consequences of that. We then pay collectively a lot more money for hospital care of treating potentially preventable complications of diabetes.
We're talking right now with Dr. Jeremy Green about prescription drug spending in the United States. According to a new report, Americans spent more than ever on drugs last year. It's a big jump from where we were at in 2013. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
If you're taking prescription drugs, have you been spending more on them lately? And why do you think that is? And if you work in the medical community or for an insurance company, what do you make about all of this? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Dr. Jeremy Green about prescription drug spending in the U.S. We set a spending record, apparently, in 2014, according to a new report. We're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself spending more on prescription these days? Or someone in your family, are you concerned with what you're paying? If you're in the medical field, what do you think about this news? What do you see going on in your practice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Casey on the line in Bayfield. Casey, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, what do you think?
My question is, your guest said he's not an economist. I'm currently in college for economics right now, and in one of my classes, they talked specifically about insulin, so that was really interesting to me that he brought it up. Insulin, from what I got from the lecture, is kind of a special area of economics because there's not really a viable alternative for it. Does the guest have... Does he see this often, that there's no alternative and that could potentially be driving up the cost of healthcare?
Interesting, Casey. Thanks for bringing that up. Dr. Green, are there a lot of medications where it's this one or nothing else?
Oh, there are plenty of medications where it's this one or nothing else. But I guess a lot depends on what we call the category of this one, right? Mm. So So this is often important when there's a patent-based monopoly, and I think that's the way that the current insulin market works in the United States, is that the existing insulins have been protected by patents. A lot of the conversation about insulin right now focuses on the fact that current insulins that are on the U.S. market are products of biotech, and biotech drugs are more expensive. It's also harder to figure out how to regulate generic copies of biotech drugs, partly because we haven't developed an effective regulatory pathway. It's really just under construction right now. It's not quite the same as older drugs where it's a chemical where you know where every atom is. So a lot of conversations about why there's no generic insulin focused about the fact that no biosimilar drugs have been approved for market yet. And yet, as a historian, I guess my answer here to Casey is that there actually are many alternatives to insulin that aren't considered, which is to say one alternative that not being considered to present-day biotech insulins. There are the older animal insulins that used to be produced and sold effectively on the American market for quite cheap prices and worked for many, many people living with diabetes. Now, the newer insulins, the biotech recombinant DNA human insulins, the synthetic analogs, are better. They're slightly better. But they are certainly, you know, the older insulins are certainly better than no insulin at all. So as a historian, I think it's important to take a longer perspective on things and realize there are actually alternatives to the insulin market today that we're not seeing. And those alternatives are the products that used to be here 2 and 3 decades ago that we now have no access to.
Thanks for the call, Casey. We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Abby on the line in Appleton. Abby, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm calling. I have a 14-year-old son that has very severe Crohn's disease, and he needs a monthly infusion of Remicade, which is in the neighborhood of $20,000 every month. Now, that is considered a prescription drug, not hospital treatment, even though he needs to be hospitalized for it. So we actually just moved from the Madison area because our insurance told us that American Family Hospital charges nearly twice what Children's Hospital in Nina does. So they are willing to cover more of it there. But I mean, at any rate, at this point, we are going to be filing bankruptcy so my son can get the medication he needs.
Wow. Abby, you said $20,000 a month?
Correct.
Abby, thank you. Good luck to you and your family dealing with that. Wow, there's a lot there, Dr. Green. Let's start with this a huge variation in the amount one hospital versus another hospital or provider might charge for the same medication. Is that a common story?
It is a very common story, unfortunately. And Abby, first of all, let me say thanks for sharing your story. And I'm very sorry to hear that you and your family are filing personal bankruptcy for health-related expenses. And unfortunately, you are one of many, many American households that are forced into this situation because of the rising costs of health care. And again, what you're discussing is not a boutique form of health care, but really an essential medicine for the management of your son's illness, Crohn's disease, which is a very common chronic disease in the United States. To get at this problem of variation, there's a group in Dartmouth that began to publish a Dartmouth Health Atlas, which looked at geographical variations of health expenditures. And there are extraordinary differences in the costs of procedures between different regions of the country and between different towns and cities within the same region. And again, you're describing your own personal migration of how American families are choosing where they live now, are being forced to relocate based on differential health expenditures. And I think it's a real shame as to where our biomedical system has come to, that our ability to guarantee basic standards of health care for our citizens has been so compromised.
Abby, thanks for calling. And again, good luck to you. We're talking to Dr. Jeremy Green about the cost of medications, prescription medications, here in the United States. Jason is with us next in Menominee. Jason, hi.
Hey. Hey, thanks for having me on. So I guess my question is, how would this be a regulatory type of a deal? I'm not a big fan of government regulation of private enterprise, so I'm wondering if there's a way kind of, I guess, to sidestep this. If like Canada, Mexico, India, whatever, pays $1 a pill, and we pay $10 a pill or something like that. Would there be a way of, like, just saying we're not paying any more than the lowest payer out there, you know, we as in the United States people, and, you know, not to say that we should only pay a dollar bill because I'm, you know, all for R&D and stuff like that, but, you know, just to make them kind of bump the prices up a little bit to these other customers. And
gotcha. Jason, I want to jump in because we're a little short on time. Dr. Green, first, is that Jason's premise right? Do we generally pay more for the same drug here in the U.S. versus other developed countries?
Oh, without a doubt, he's right on there.
All right. And then he's asking, I guess, if there are ways to even that out, either by making other countries pay more or by negotiating and saying, why are we paying so much more than those other countries? A huge question. A lot of people have been tackling this. Do you have thoughts on that, though?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. And I've approached it, you know, as a historian, looking at the singularity of the American drug market, why we pay so much, why we have so many prescriptions per capita on the one hand, but why we pay so much more for those prescriptions as well. It's fascinating to me, Jason, your suggestion here that what we should do is make other countries pay more for the price of innovation. And certainly this is something that pharmaceutical manufacturers in the United States have been arguing for years, that prescription drug prices need to be high in America because we are the place where we are the market that sustains innovation. At the same time, the reason those drug prices are lower in places like Canada and the UK is because these are countries who have actually used their national health systems to negotiate lower prices of drugs, something we have consistently refused to do in discussions of pharmaceutical policy in the United States. When Medicare Part D went through, expanding dramatically the federal government's involvement in paying for prescription drug use in the United States, riders were put on the bill expressly prohibiting the use of the power of the purse to negotiate lower prices. So we've done everything we can in national policy to not negotiate lower prices in the U.S. So it seems kind of ironic to then try and chastise other countries that have.
So, Dr. Green, briefly, as we wrap up, we had the Affordable Care Act debate. Is anybody trying to change things? Do you see policy moves, industry moves, anybody trying to bring these prices down for the newer drugs that we've been focusing on?
Well, I mean, I think original sin comes as no surprise. On the one hand, it's not surprising that if we have an arena in which pharmaceutical companies are allowed to set whatever price they want for a drug, they will set high prices. And until we try and do things to create leverage points and buyer points where prices can, where lower prices and more reasonable prices can be incented, I think the system will work as it's built to work, as it's intended to work. What I am concerned about, what I'm following closely in Congress right now, are unexpected price hikes that have been happening in the generic drug domain. A review of CMS data recently found that 10% of generic drugs doubled in price in the recent year, and that half of all generic drugs increased in cost from 2013 to 2014. So this arena in which we expect to see price savings, the generic drug arena, is now showing unexpected price hikes and drug shortages.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Green, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Jeremy Green, a professor of medicine and history of medicine at Johns Hopkins University.